Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, at the outset, may I congratulate the organizers of this conference on international criminal law for focusing on a subject of immense importance in today's violence-ridden world. For maintaining a just world order, the basic tenets of international law and adherence to its rules cannot be ignored or brushed aside. We can tackle the global problems of climate change, terrorism, and armed conflict only by working together to find common approaches. In such times, it is important to strengthen existing norms and, wherever necessary, create new norms. International law is more relevant today than ever before, and theoretical inquiries into its sub-disciplines, such as ICL, are necessary for its growth. Hence the congratulatory note. ICL is a relatively young field and remains, to some extent, undeveloped. It did not grow out of existing practice and consensus, like most of international law, nor was it theorized and set in motion to address a growing need, like other niche areas, such as space law. Instead, it was created almost out of thin air to deal with the aftermath of calamity. In that sense, most of what we see today as international criminal law is law created for and practiced by the ad hoc tribunals stretching from Nuremberg to Yugoslavia and Rwanda. This ad hoc approach was then generalized to form the backbone of the ICC, an ambitious project for such a young intellectual discipline. Nevertheless, as far as India is concerned, this ambitious project was not actually a rabbit out of thin air. We have been familiar with its core principles for millennia. The laws of armed conflict were discussed as early as in 2000 BCE in the Mahabharata and again in the Ramayana, both Hindu epics, where the use of weapons of mass destruction, which killed even unarmed civilians, were prohibited as being against the prevailing moral values of the time. Judge Nagendra Singh of the International Court of Justice discussed how these morals developed into norms in the later Manusmriti from the 4th century BCE, where a wide variety of weapons that could cause unnecessary suffering, such as arrows with heated, poisoned, or hooked ends, were prohibited in battle. These norms required that those who surrender free or are otherwise hors de combat were not to be attacked, foreshadowing protections of prisoners of war. Precursors of modern laws of warfare are found in the Dharma Shastra, such as a differentiation between a just and unjust war and military and non-military targets. Drawing from these rules, Kautilya, an advisor to the Maurya ruler Chandragupta, advocated similar rules in his political treatise, the Arthashastra, written between the 3rd and 4th centuries BCE. What is even more interesting is that it was not merely rules of warfare that were laid out, much like in the current international legal system. Violation of these rules entailed something similar to criminal, or at the very least, moral responsibility. The 12th book of the epic Mahabharata, the Shanti Parv, describes how violators of the laws of war were classed as outcasts and stripped of privileges. Even later in 256 BCE, the Emperor Ashoka, after witnessing the unnecessary suffering caused by his military conquest of Kalinga, took the moral blame upon himself and renounced war, turning to Buddhism instead. He laid down his dhammas or edicts, the 13th of which advocated that military conquests, if carried out at all, should be done with forbearance and light punishment. There was thus a deep sense of moral recognition and familiarity in ancient India, and as will be discussed during the technical sessions in this seminar, across the world for these principles of international humanitarian and criminal law as a precursor to the Geneva Conventions. In its current form, ICL draws from the philosophical underpinnings of both criminal and international law. In one sense, it can be seen as their logical extension. Criminal law has, at its core, the idea that individuals should agree to certain minimum rules of conduct within a society, the violation of which could be classified as morally wrong. International law rests on an analogous basis that nation states should agree on certain minimum rules of conduct to promote a peaceful world order. Increasingly, these minimum standards in international law tend towards upholding humanitarian values. Accordingly, it would seem natural for acts contravening both these standards, acts that are both criminal within a society and acts in contravention of international humanitarian standards, to be prosecuted internationally in addition to domestically. However, alongside this fundamental consonance of values is also a dissonance, namely that international law upholds state sovereignty, which would oppose any outside interference, including through criminal prosecutions. However, the Second World War drove home the point that certain atrocities were so grave that it was not just that society, but the entire world that was invested in punishing and preventing such acts. Since acts of this magnitude were usually committed by those with access to the state machinery, it became doubly important that international accountability be established, since the likelihood of domestic prosecution was low. An international mechanism thus became a necessity. It was in this attempt to reconcile the irreconcilable that modern ICL was born. It carved out treaty-bound exceptions to sovereignty, allowing international prosecutions in these limited circumstances. This was on the jurisprudential back of universal criminal jurisdiction over such serious crimes, a concept earlier extended only to crimes such as piracy on the high seas, which were outside any nation's purview, but which was expanded to fit these new needs. However, when this was first achieved at Nuremberg and Tokyo, it was seen, hopefully perhaps at that time, as a legal exception for the extraordinary circumstances of the Second World War. It did not seem likely that the world, or the West at any rate, would see genocide and its like again. The war in Yugoslavia and the simultaneous genocide in Rwanda put an end to this view. New tribunals were created by Security Council resolutions, but their ad hoc nature retreated to the idea of ICL as an exceptional measure. Hence, naturally, it has been difficult to tie these individual limited experiments in ICL into a grand academic and philosophical theory. However, the recognition in the 1990s of the inevitability of conflict alongside a lowering of the humanitarian standards for overruling state sovereignty culminated in several attempts to do so. To give a few examples, certain states took the idea to its furthest logical endpoint by opening themselves out to unfettered universal jurisdiction over any serious crime committed by any person in any part of the world. However, the multiplicity of litigations and allegations of infringement of sovereignty by affected third-party states led Belgium and Spain, two of the most notable examples, to retreat from this stance. On the other hand, general international law advanced more cautiously by way of the Rome Statute to extend a limited universal jurisdiction to a neutral international court, that is the ICC. Limited because jurisdiction did not extend retroactively, did not extend to cases already tried elsewhere or which could potentially be tried domestically, and more importantly, did not extend to the territory or nationals of states not party to the Rome Statute. Nevertheless, this has been the boldest experiment in ICL to date, pushing the practical boundaries of the field closer to its jurisprudential ends. However, now, as the ICC reaches the end of its second decade, it is more important than ever that ICL turn its gaze inwards to strengthen its core theoretical foundations in order to ensure that it remains efficacious. This is especially true in light of the jolt the field received at the start of this year, when following on the heels of the withdrawal by Russia and three African states on the Rome Statute, the African Union itself threatened a mass withdrawal. This did not come to pass, with South Africa and Gambia both retracting their statements, but it highlighted the need for introspection. Is international justice through the ICC a better resolution than regionalized or ad hoc justice? The spate of withdrawals were based on claims that deeper neo-imperialist biases were at play in the choice of cases prosecuted at the ICC. It seems that regional ICL solutions rather than a universal one might be one answer. Again, to give a few examples, Senegal's successful prosecution of the former Chadian dictator Hissène Habré offers a strong case for regional justice mechanisms. Extraordinary African chambers constituted within the Senegalese court structure, staffed by Senegalese and African Union judges and prosecutors, provided a uniquely African solution to African crimes. Hybrid courts, such as the one in Cambodia, with a certain degree of international scrutiny and control, but with sufficient local representation as well, may also be a more acceptable negotiation of issues of sovereignty and local accountability. However, Sri Lanka's resistance to setting up such a tribunal to prosecute alleged war crimes during the LTTE conflict shows that some states may be unwilling to admit even so much of an incursion into their sovereignty. The last remaining solution is an entirely domestic one. Bangladesh, for instance, has constituted a domestic war crimes tribunal to deal with crimes committed by its own nationals during an international armed conflict. This attempt has met with some criticism as regards its independence and impartiality. Further, its structural inability to prosecute foreign nationals for related crimes is another obstacle to this being a comprehensive solution. In Sri Lanka's case as well, insistence on an entirely domestic tribunal, if at all, has been at the expense of the Tamil minority's concerns regarding the reliability of such prosecution. This is, of course, the inevitable side effect of hyper-localization of international criminal justice. By their very nature, crimes of such scale are often tied to the political apparatus of nations, and their domestic prosecution will always be riddled with the victor's biases. Thus, localization may not be the automatic answer to the problem of ICL and the ICC. Nevertheless, regional solutions do have their advantages. The ICTY, for example, was distanced to some extent from its own victims, witnesses, and the society it seeks to serve by language. A tribunal functioning in English and French was prosecuting crimes conceived in BCS, shorthand for the dialectic variations of the Yugoslav language. Even today, outreach includes translations and publicity of proceedings in the region in order to aid the rehabilitative process, something localized proceedings could achieve more organically. In fact, one of the successes of the Habré prosecution was that victims of sexual crimes felt far more comfortable traveling to Senegal, being within their cultural and geographic comfort zone, than they would have been traveling to the cold northern shores of The Hague to the ICC. This easy access to witness and victim testimony made the prosecution that much easier. Even after prosecutions are concluded and convictions are entered, international justice poses further quandaries. The same concerns that drive international rather than domestic prosecutions would also militate against holding these criminals in their home countries. Questions of safety and impartiality would always remain, but this then poses the problem of where to detain them. High security detention centers are expensive and cumbersome, and third-party states may often be unwilling to take on this additional burden. For instance, in Charles Taylor's case, the Netherlands took on pre-conviction detention with the specific caveat that his final sentence would be enforced elsewhere. Even when willing countries are identified, the convicts themselves may raise concerns. One of the post-conviction issues in the ICTY is of detainees seeking transfers to different enforcement states from those chosen for them, claiming linguistic and cultural alienation and consequent exacerbation of their punishment. These are all issues that might be resolved more easily through regional justice mechanisms. Lastly, there is the question of the future. Military technologies have progressed considerably, and the ambit of modern warfare covers autonomous weapons systems, drones, and cyber warfare. While we must first determine the permissibility of such technology under international humanitarian law, it will also soon be necessary to determine the legal framework within which, if permissible, they will operate. This will include the question of how we will assign moral culpability under ICL for the actions of such non-sentient systems. This is a jurisprudential challenge that must be tackled head-on before such situations play out, in order to ensure that the existing system of prevention and punishment remains relevant in the future as well. There is thus no better time to review the foundations, consider the limits, and envisage the potential of ICL, a crucial field of law. It has contributed immensely in healing the wounds of the past, but for its future, one hopes that it can grow into an effective enough deterrent to forestall any tragedy. With these words, I formally inaugurate this seminar and wish all the speakers and all the participants all the best and wonderful deliberations over the next 2 days. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.